The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Kahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I'm excited to welcome our guests this evening. If you are someone who enjoys good food, then you're in the right place. Leaders in a food revolution that sees mainstream chefs putting vegetables at the center of the plate, Philly natives and husband and wife team Rich Landau and Kate Jacoby are co-owners of Veg, a local mecca for foodies since 2011. You knew that. Landau opened his first restaurant in 1994 and is notable for serving the first ever vegan dinner at the James Beard House. Jacoby serves as Veg's pastry chef and runs its cocktail and wine program. They are also owners of V Street, a street food bar based on their shared love of travel and food cultures. They join us tonight to talk about their eponymous book, a tasty compendium of more than 100 recipes inspired by the great street foods of the world. They will be interviewed this evening by longtime Philadelphia Inquirer food editor Maureen Fitzgerald. Please join me in welcoming Rich Landau, Kate Jacoby, and Maureen Fitzgerald.
Good evening, and thank you all so much for coming out tonight. I'm so excited to be talking to Rich and Kate. I've eaten at their restaurants many times, and they have another new cookbook out, as you know, B Street, based on their very popular street food restaurant, B Street. And so we have a few questions that we're going to ask them. So congratulations on your cookbook.
Thank you.
Very exciting. And also congratulations on the new concept of Whiz Kids.
Thank you.
Your fast food concept that's going to be next door from B Street and also at Whole Foods this fall.
This time next week, actually.
Oh, is that when you're opening?
Yeah, indeed. There's a lot going on right now.
You heard it here first, yes. Right? They're opening Whiz Kids. So when you started with Horizons Cafe next to that health food store in Willow Grove, did you have a vision for the family of restaurants that you would create? Or did you really think that the number of vegetarians and vegans would grow the way that it has? Did you foresee the growth?
Well, in 94, when this started, you know, it opened up in Willow Grove, which, of course, is a vegetarian wasteland there, food wasteland also. And, you know, I had this opportunity. This health food store, Nature's Harvest, was going to be opening up another health food store, and that's where the restaurant was supposed to be, in Plymouth Meeting. So what happened was they said, come on in here, work with us for a little bit, and we'll see how it goes. We'll develop a working relationship, and then we'll expand to Plymouth Meeting. So Plymouth Meeting never happened, so I really just stayed in Willow Grove, and I kept the menu really inexpensive, really approachable.
Nothing over $5, as I recall.
Maureen, you remember. I'm so flattered. So I was expecting college hippie crowd, you know, from Arcadia, coming in, drinking coffee. And lo and behold, all these suits and ties showed up from the business parks down in Dresher. And for dinner as well, families were coming in. So I realized there was a bigger draw and a bigger desire for this food than what I previously thought. I wanted to just really stay low key, and it just kept going and going from there. Did I envision we'd be here today, sitting on a stage with you? I mean, no, not really. That's as much of a surprise to me as anybody else, and it's amazing to have come this far. But I never saw it back then, though. I didn't think we'd get this big.
When you started, I remember you telling me that you, when you saw that there was more suits coming in, you saw that the vegan and vegetarian movement was larger than you thought. But did you ever anticipate, like, how widespread that it would get? Like, in your mind, did you say, people are going to want to save the planet, this is the boat that we have to get on?
Well, I think a lot of it came down to the fact that what I understood from an early on point was that people love good food. You just have to know how to cook. I think people were always under the assumption that it was meat that gave them the flavor and the satisfaction they were enjoying on the plate. It really isn't. It's what chefs do to it that makes it delicious. Like if you boiled a piece of chicken, it wouldn't taste very good. So, you know, I really set out to put the same kind of flavor into all the vegetables I was cooking. And, you know, back then we used a little mock meat as well, hoping to draw people into the flavor. And I realized that people just want good food. You know, if you can make a meal better than any other restaurant, people didn't really care whether or not there was meat in it. And I think that
have a lot of competition in Willow Grove.
No, right. Or is that endless bowl of salad at the Olive Garden? That was a killer.
That was great.
So, that became my prime directive, you know, to steal a Star Trek phrase there, is just to really focus on giving people, talking about what's on the plate and not making excuses or apologies for what wasn't on the plate.
I would add to that. In the early days, it was almost our mission. Like when I joined up with Rich in 2001, I saw very clearly the struggle of the stereotype of being a vegetarian or vegan restaurant. And we tried very actively to disrupt that and to offer something different and to really focus on the delicious food, because people had such preconceived notions about what it meant to offer a totally vegetarian meal, or like I would say back then, vegan, because no one knew what it was. So we tried really hard to sort of offer something new as an example that people could be like, oh, I'm inspired by that. It's not threatening. That's really cool. I want to try that. And I think in recent years, it's like a beautiful happening that people are, for health, animal rights, of course, but environment, for all of these reasons, people are approaching this with a new energy, one they would not have considered certainly 10 years ago, maybe not even like 6 or 7. It's kind of new.
The vegetarian restaurants that were around were not very inspiring. I think of the Moosewood restaurant that was so famous and, you know, launched the cookbook, and I've gone back to that cookbook and made stuff out of it. It's terrible. I actually had occasion to eat at the restaurant. Not great.
We actually just hired someone from there.
Oh, sorry about that.
The first thing I told her, no, I said, I want you to forget everything you know.
Oh, okay. Have you eaten there?
No, we've never been there. But I do agree with you, because back in the late 90s, there was really... I remember Scene had a little cafe, which I thought was really nice. But all the vegetarian restaurants were the cliched vegetarian hippie places. You know, you go in, it smells like patchouli, and, you know, the service was really slow. It was really embarrassing. And I was like, wait a second, why is this associated with like this movement and this cause and this lifestyle? It's food. And that's why we always chose to never play up the vegan or vegetarian thing. You know, veg is a vegetable restaurant, because we are a restaurant that serves vegetables. It's not about a lifestyle. We're not trying to preach. There's no one in a cow suit with a meat is murder sign out front, you know? So yeah, it's about what it is, not about what it isn't.
Can you talk about how the two of you met originally and then sort of how you work together day in and day out?
So I, at some point, discovered Horizons Cafe in Willow Grove back when it was either Rich or Rick. I didn't know his name, but I knew that...
She still doesn't.
Everybody else calls him Chef now. I'm like, I'm calling him Rich. But I would go in there as a customer, and it was like a little 10-seat counter, and he had a little ponytail, and he wore Chili Pepper Chef pants, and he had the Horizons T-shirt cut off at the sleeves. And I didn't, you know, I went in there for the food, and like I kind of watched this guy who would take pre-cooked pasta out of a big white bucket. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense, right? Like that you wouldn't cook the pasta to order. That would take too long. So I had this idea of like who he was, but it was the food that really got me in there. And I became a regular, went to college, would continue to want to always dine at this restaurant. And I studied French and sociology and was supposed to go on to like maybe become a sociology professor. But one thing led to another. I took a summer job in Willow Grove as a host, and then
at the restaurant
at Horizons Cafe. Did go to grad school, but decided that I loved the restaurant industry. This man who I had met, who was, you know, now I knew Rich, I loved what he was doing, and I think that I had embraced it as a customer first, I'm not a very good salesperson, but if I love something, I get obsessed and I can't stop talking about it, as you know. So it was very natural for me, and then I just kind of wanted to take it out for a spin and work as much with him to learn, to see how far we could take it, because I believed so much in what we were doing. However we could attract people and get them tuned into what they were doing, I knew that they would like be on board and be as big a fan as I might be. So.
And can you tell from your perspective how you met your wife?
Yeah, I mean, from being on the other end of that, I remember her coming in for a job, and we just hit it off. Next thing you know, she's working in the kitchen. Your first prep job was picking thyme, if I remember right.
Big deal.
we hit it off instantly.
I was going to say, was there like the instant connection?
I think so, yeah. The chemistry was intense. And
when she came in and applied for the job, you were like, yes, you're hired.
I don't care. Yeah, she's like, oh, I was fired from my last job from stealing, spent 10 years in prison. You know, I got fired for putting bacon into a veggie burger. Oh, you're hired. It's okay, you know. No, we just hit it off right away. And next thing you know, we're hanging out, you know, after work and having a glass of wine together. And we thought we were being so discreet. And the whole staff, of course, knew it the whole time. They're like, you guys are pathetic. You can't hide this. You're so obvious. And so, you know, we just kind of, one thing led to another. And we started working together. And, you know, Kate's the ambitious one. I think I would have been happy with Veg and maybe View Street. But now we're going to take over the world. So, right, see, now you're encouraging her. Don't applaud for that. I'm tired.
I love it. I love it. We'll talk a little bit about what it's like to work with your partner, your business partner, your spouse. How does that, do you divide and conquer? How do you make that work? That's always a challenge.
I think in the early days, we would sort of go with the flow. I learned so much. You know, I was coming from a different background. I'd only hosted in one other restaurant, and Rich was putting in the longest hours, being on the line, picking up the produce, like being on the phone, dealing with every aspect of the business he handled. So I just paid close attention, and when I knew I could take something off his plate, I would do that. And eventually, we moved downtown, and it started to divide a little bit because there was like this front and back of house. As the restaurants got bigger and more complicated, we learned, hey, you know, this is something you love to do. You're really good at this. You do this. So there was a little bit of a division between I went front of house, Rich's back of house, and also I took pastry and the beverage program, which still the rest of the menu is, you know, is first and foremost. But I think it's really like comes back to that idea that I was such a huge fan of his cooking and it really informed me and everything I knew about balancing flavors and making something really just like craveable. So we have a very shared palate that we continue to develop with travel. We eat all our meals together, like we're always together. So I think we trust each other and understand like what we're best at.
Yeah, and I think dividing up the work. I do X and Kate does Y, and I think that's really important. And, you know, we're always there to support each other, and we always say we're each other's biggest fans and each other's biggest critics. And if it's handled with love and respect, I don't really, you know, it's not really a problem.
So you don't have, like, knockdown dragouts in the middle of the restaurant. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, well, if the crowd's a little sleepy, we try to liven it up like that, you know.
I'll throw a pie across the room.
So the last time I talked to you, it was only 3 years ago, and I was talking to you about your cookbook, Veg, and you were being celebrated for elevating, you know, vegan cooking to the fine dining level. And now here you are going in the completely opposite direction with street food.
Yes.
Can you talk about why you wanted to do that and how that sort of progressed to the point where you were opening V Street and now writing that cookbook?
I think we're really just following where the market's going. Kate and I are actually huge fans of fine dining. When we travel, there's two experiences we cherish the most. Going to a very nice white tablecloth fine dining restaurant and being pampered, great wine service, you know, three courses of bread to begin the meal, you know how it goes. And, you know, we're really sad that doesn't exist in Philadelphia anymore. And then the other experience we love is just a sand floor, little wooden table, you know, where the locals are eating, you know, there's smoke billowing out from a little chimney under a shack roof. We love those two very, very different dining experiences. when we travel, you know. So I think that's formed our identity of what we want, but you know, you also have to listen to what the market is, where the market's going. And you know, you look in Philadelphia, you know, Garces and Vetri and Solo, they've only been answering a call that chefs nationally have been doing for a while, because we're always a few steps behind in Philly. But you know, like Jose Andreas, Bobby Flay, you know, all these big name chefs have all gone the fast casual route. And it's not because they have a desire to flip burgers or anything like that or make a great taco. It's because they're answering the call of where the American dining scene is going. And it is headed towards fast casual. It's a very millennial-driven market. Millennials want great quality ingredients, cooked by a chef, you know, at a fair price with a lot of without a lot of pretense, and they want it in 3 minutes. So that's where it's kind of going. So we're basically answering the call. And we do love this kind of food. It's going to be really, really great what we're going to do with WizKid. In our hearts, I would love to do a white tablecloth fine dining vegetable restaurant. But I think veg is as far as we can push it in the city of Philadelphia.
So we're this pendulum. We'll just keep going back and forth.
Well, everybody wants the next Shake Shack, right? Is that what WizKids is?
You're
the one that's scalable that you can take nationwide. That
I think it comes down to like what are we most inspired by at this exact moment. So for veg, we were going into the Tiger Building. You know, this gorgeous, beautiful gorgeous building with the history of Duchaminet behind it and the Princeton Club. We actually didn't want to do something quite so elegant, but it was a good fit. It made sense at the time, and veg took on a life of its own. It just became this like experience, and you'd see people coming in to celebrate their anniversaries and their birthdays. So I guess the idea with V Street was sort of like when we would travel and we'd try some really spicy dish, whatever it was. I know Kung Pao was like this revelation for us. We thought this doesn't quite fit into the veg experience. So V Street was born. You know, it was this idea of like, we're eating these spicy noodle bowls at home and for breakfast every day after our trip to Japan, and it was like, we can't really do a noodle bowl at veg. It just doesn't seem right. So we were coming up with all this like new material, and it was like we needed a new home for it. So that was V Street, and then, you know, we've been there for 2 years now. So the lovely thing is we keep attracting really wonderful people to help us out, because obviously we can't do it alone. So the more people that want to do what we're doing and help us out, the more we can do.
Can you talk about how you develop the flavors at both restaurants? Because I think most people think of flavors being centered around meat and getting the flavor from the fat, from the meat. And actually, I find the flavors at V Street to be bolder than the flavors at Veg. So can you talk about sort of what the character you were looking for? Yeah. For each, in terms of the food for each restaurant, not only the informality, but the flavor mm-hmm. profile.
I mean, I'd like to think that if people eat at both restaurants, they can see that the food came from the same brain, but they're just, you know, a completely different. To me, V Street and Veg are as different as you can be in the city. And when I walk back and forth each night, I mean, it's a completely different identity. But the flavor goes back to what I was saying before. And this is what I've always said, and we talk about this in the book and in the veg book, that you, if you're going to cook just vegetables and convince people that, you know, they can enjoy a meal without meat, you've got to get deep, deep layers of flavor into everything. You can't just boil a carrot. You can't just roast a head of cauliflower. You have to really, really put some work into it.
And how do you do that? How do you get
well,
that deep flavor?
Well, a lot of our food goes through a multi-step process. Now, if you take our carrot right now, that we have this carrot that's this whole roasted carrot that's on the menu at Veg right now. So those carrots are first blanched in a stock that's with thyme, bay leaf, and peppercorns. After they cool, they're then roasted in the oven. They're split in half, roasted in the oven, face down, so that they caramelize a little bit with a little bit of Montreal steak spice and a little bit of sunflower oil, neutral oil. After that, they go onto the char grill where we get some mesquite, cherry, and applewood chips going. They're smoking, and we put some grill marks on it and let the smoke get up in there to it. And then they're chilled, so we're allowing the texture of the carrot to set. Then, finally, when someone orders it, it goes on the plancha, the flat-top griddle, to get one more layer of caramelization. You know, because the carrot has a lot of sugar in it, we're using the natural sugars to help caramelize the face of it. So by doing all that, you know, we're putting the same work into a vegetable that a lot of chefs would put into a protein. And that's how we try to stay convincing on the plate, you know.
Or maybe a little more than the chefs have to put into the...
That's
labor-intensive.
It's very labor-intensive. You know, there, for each night at Veg, there are 38 hours of labor that goes into it during the day, starting with our pastry chef in the morning, then all the prepping that goes on. 38 hours of labor on an average day that goes into making one night of service at Veg. And I think that's been the key to it, is that a lot of people do cook vegetables at home, and they can roast Brussels sprouts, they can roast their cauliflower, they can sear up some broccoli. What haven't they thought of? What brings vegetables into the center of the plate where the meat used to be? To make vegetables shine is like a main focus of the plate, and that's what's always driven us, and to get those flavors in there. Now, to answer your question about V Street, the flavor, you know, we love spice, we love ethnic foods. The ones that have become a little bit too funky and a little out there, they go over to V Street. And the nice part is now when we come up with a dish, we can decide where it's going to land in which restaurant, which I think has been great, because there were some, you know, like we opened up Veg and we had this funky kimchi stew on this on the menu. And it was great, but it stood out like a sore thumb, you know, on the menu. So it's pretty cool to have the choice there.
So it's definitely you make the decision that this is going to be the bolder flavors at V Street.
Absolutely, yeah. Just celebrating the great street foods of the world, bold flavor. There's a lot of spice at V Street. We didn't try, you know, it's a small space. The luxury of not having to be all things to all people. I think at Veg, we tried to always cast a wide net and try to get as many people in there to, you know, kind of break down those barriers of what vegan or vegetarian cuisine could be. At V Street, we were definitely honing in on people that craved excitement and spice, you know, and adventure on their plate. You know, it's definitely not a, you know, kind of a baked potato kind of restaurant, a safe haven for anyone. There's very few safe things on that menu.
So when I looked at the cookbook, I thought it's really much more than a vegan cookbook. It's really kind of a primer on international cooking, mm-hmm. with your sections where, you know, the spices to get from which markets, Indian markets, Mexican markets, and even where you can get them in Philadelphia. Are these recipes in the book that labor-intensive? They seemed simpler to me. This is a simplified version of something that you would get.
And some of them, yeah.
Yeah, I think, for one thing, when we were opening V Street, we paid really close attention. We took careful notes, and we actually created recipes. And Veg is changing the menu all the time, so it's incredibly chef-driven. It's very scented. We're always working with something new, and everything changes. So you write it down, and 2 days later, it's different. But at V Street, we knew we had a small kitchen. We had certain limitations, so we were a little bit more careful about that. So when we went to tweak them for the book so people could make it at home, there's very little adjusting. We knew exactly what we wanted and like what would be a little too hard. The publishers, of course, were making certain recommendations, like don't fry everything. Like people don't want to fry everything. We're like, no, well, we don't either, but there's certain things like our langoche, like it's so good.
It is. I agree with you.
And we were in the hands of some very good publishers this time around. They took really good care of us. They had a direction they wanted to take us in. And, you know, we had to, you know, sacrifice a little bit of our creative input. But the final product were really
But honestly,
really
they look approachable. They look really approachable.
And there are certain things we didn't put in because we just knew wouldn't be great. But across the board, I was like, these are almost too good. I'm not sure if people are, you know, they're going to just stay home and make this food. But one of the things that we, like, sort of charged ourselves with was to, you know, vegan cookbooks. There are a ton of vegan cookbooks. There weren't that many, you know, however many years ago. But I said to Rich, I feel, you know, this is not an authentic, you know, Hungarian cookbook that you're going to learn all these true Hungarian recipes or, you know, Sichuan Chinese recipes. But under the vegan umbrella that I think people do trust us to carry, we can translate different food cultures from around the world. And because the food is coming from the same brain, it's all going to fit from your book. And you can come into the restaurant and have a smorgasbord of different types of foods, but the approach to the cooking is similar. So it actually really works together. At least I think so.
There have been a couple of sensations on the internet in terms of vegan food, and one there's one for each of you. One is obviously the Impossible Burger that bleeds, and then there's the aquafaba chickpea water. Can you talk about them? Will you ever put an Impossible? Tell the audience what the Impossible Burger is.
So the next generation of veggie burger are going to be these, I'm sure you guys know most veggie burgers, they're like a very thin kind of McDonald's type hamburger, which are great. They're wonderful, convincing items that show people why eat a McDonald's hamburger when you can eat this, you know, alternative to it. You know, there's, but you know, what was missing in the burger repertoire for, you know, for a lot of people, you know, probably like your food critic as well, were these big beefy burgers that, you know, they, I remember these from my childhood. They're like, you know, 3 inches thick and they're like, you know, one color on the outside and one color on the inside. And I miss that very much. So that's the next generation of burgers. Impossible Burger and Beyond Burger, I believe, are the two. They're very thick. They're pink. They look like raw meat. And when you cook them, they cook. You wouldn't really be able to tell the difference. But they're thick and the flavor is ridiculously convincing. So that's what's next. And I'm all for it. You know,
Will you put one on your menu at WizKids?
We talked about that. We have to decide whether or not that is chef-driven or not. Now, David Chang has one on his menu at Mama Fuko. You know, so it's something we have to really think about. Are we doing it for us and a chef ego perspective, or are we doing what we are? Are we going to be true to our message of getting out there a product that's going to really convince people that, you know, not it's trying to make vegans out of anyone, but at least convince them that what we do is legitimate and that meat isn't really about meat. It's about, you know, again, what chefs do to it. And I think these burgers are really convincing tools. So if we don't do it, someone else will probably, and that's fine as well. And I have nothing against mock meats. I really don't. We have some in our refrigerator at home. They're wonderful transitional, you know, things to play with that can really make believers out of people. The vegan salami and vegan bologna makes you wonder, what are they putting in the real thing? I mean, it's like, you know, what part of...
It's interesting, too, because we both grew up eating everything. So that idea of a transitional food is important to us. You know, at some point, if people are dabbling in a more plant-based diet, whether they're going all vegan or not, you have a certain idea of what a meal is and what protein does and how it makes you feel full. But I know our son, if we offer him any kind of like veggie bologna or something like that, he's not into it. He doesn't miss it because he doesn't know any different. So
he's never had it.
Yeah, he doesn't.
We should give a shout out. My before and after are here. Our son, Rio Jacoby Landau, and my dad, Mike Landau, are in the back. So,
hi, guys.
Hi, before and after. And one of my sisters. I can't tell them apart from this distance. I think that's Suzanne. Yes.
Hi. So talk about the aquafaba, the chickpea water that is an amazing substitute for egg whites.
How many of you have heard of this aquafaba? Yeah. Cool. So if you're opening up a can of chickpeas and you drain it out and you go right into the colander, you just lost all your aquafaba. You're supposed to drain it out, capture the liquid that was in the can, and then you take that and you put a hand mixer on it. And after 1 minute, it starts to puff up quite a bit. And after 2 minutes, it starts to get a little bit more solid. 3, 4, 5, you have like a stiff peak egg white. And I heard people talking about it, and someone's like, hey, you know, have you tried this? And I'm like, no, that sounds weird. It's going to taste funny. But then a couple people, you know, reminded me, and I said, all right, I'm going to do it. We didn't even have a hand mixer at home, so I had to borrow something from the restaurant, bring it home, because I wanted space. I can't get in the kitchen anymore. So I set it up, and I took pictures. I timed it. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is really, really cool. I'm like, well, what am I going to do with this? So the first thing I did was make a cocktail. I made a whiskey sour, and then after that I made a pisco sour, and I was amazed. I mean, it really did exactly what an egg white would do in a drink and created like a really nice texture, but also this beautiful foam on top for the pisco sour that the little bitters would float in beautifully. I took a picture, and then like 40 minutes later, the foam was still there. I thought, this is great. Okay, I'm going to make macaroons. And meringues. So I started just playing around in the kitchen, and I was really, really amazed just at how versatile it was. I didn't get as far as making like mayonnaise. I understand people are, you know, really just incorporating it into their baking. In the past with cakes and whatnot, I've always relied on a combination of other fats to get the richness that an egg yolk would do, and then I would rely on baking soda, baking powder, and acid to get the rise in the cake. So I haven't relied on them too much. To me, the sort of holy grail of vegan baking was egg white. Like, how do you work with that? So I've been pretty impressed.
I know people are just going crazy over them, so I had to ask you about it.
It's worth a try.
One last question. Can you talk about how much of your motivation comes from ethics, saving the planet, fair treatment of animals, health? Is it part of all of those things, or is it really just, I want to make food that tastes good and all of this falls into place?
Well, we always say we're chefs first. You know, we run restaurants and we deal with restaurant issues all day long like any other chef in the city. We know most of the chefs in the city. Our world is centered around being restaurateurs and running it on a day-to-day basis. We got into this very much for ethical reasons. I mean, my sister can attest to this. When we were in our teens, we're like, why are we eating this stuff? You know, in fact, I asked my dad, I think I told you a story. I asked my dad when I was very young, where did steak come from? And he said, from cows. And I imagine a cow laying a steak like a chicken would lay an egg. Not a problem, right? So when we found out, we're like, why are we eating this? So it was a very much an ethical thing that we've carried with us, both of us, our whole lives. And it's funny, the last time we were in this room, Wayne Pacell from the Humane Society was here. And, you know, when they talk about these facts and figures and these realities of what goes on, we're just really, really empowered. And, you know, we need more of that. We need to really kind of sometimes be jolted as to why we got into this in the first place. You know, our son believes in this very deeply. We've never pushed it on him, yet he believes this. So he's this living testament of, like, why we're doing this. And it really helps, because sometimes with the stress and rigors of the restaurant world, to know that you have this kind of going on behind all that is great. Now, there's that reason, and that's great. It appeals to a lot of people. The environment became a big issue, you know, especially during the Clinton administration with Gore, especially after what Gore did afterwards. So people want to save the environment. The, you know, greenhouse gases caused by cows are one of the biggest killers of the environment. And then as we're getting older and we watch our, you know, young son grow up, it becomes about personal health. And, you know, as we're getting on, you realize that this plant-based diet is not so bad. It's actually really good for you. It's good for you in so many ways, more ways than I can get into and list right now. So I tell people, like, if you can't do it for the animals and you can't do it for the environment and you can't do it for yourself, I can't help you. You're done. It's got to be one of the three. So you got to care about something. So did you want to expand on that at all?
The only thing that might be interesting for people, people are very personal. They want to know, like, what inspires you as a chef. But in this vegetarian aspect, people want to know, like, well, why are we vegetarian? And are we vegetarian? What do we do when we travel? How are you raising your son? You know, all these personal questions. And we bite our tongues a lot because we came into this with this whole, like, tear down the preconceived notions of vegetarianism. We don't want to use the V word, like, try not to do that. But, you know, I think if you really ask us very personally, that is the number one driver for us. It's about the ethical decision and not to, you know, and the impact on animal rights. That's what drives us. And then I think we're just bolstered by this idea of the environmental impact and our own human health. So it just seems like a no-brainer at this point. And yet, we know what it's like when people preach to you. And 5-10 years ago, there were, like, we would say the vegan police, who are so fierce, like, trying to tear you down. Like, I saw you eat that croissant in Paris. I saw you do it. I'm going to write about it. And you're like, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. There were a couple key examples of this in the past couple years, and I don't like that either. And I think that Rich and I have made our best, like, inroads with people when it's done in this demonstrative way where you're just sort of like, this is what we do. We try to make it so good and appealing that people want to I'll try that out. And that's much more inclusive because, you know, nobody's going to be perfect. It's not about being perfect. It's about, like, you know, maybe, like, making a suggestion, turning people onto it. And at the end of the day, like, we'll say on a Saturday night, we'll look across the room, front of house, back of house, hey, and I'm like, we've done this. Like, there's this buzzing dining room full of people. I don't know how many are vegan or how many had steak for lunch, but, like, they're all here right now. And it's, for us, very personally rewarding.
Well, and you do have a good percentage of people who are not vegetarians.
That's a nice quote.
Right? I mean, a lot of your customers are not vegetarian or vegan. They
estimate
are.
Estimate about 96%, I'd say, probably. Yeah. Or not.
So yeah. Hard to know. I think, like, when we've heard Wayne speak and with Farm Sanctuary with Gene Bauer, we were at another talk with him not too long ago, and it's just refreshing, like, the movement if we're a part of it, and I would like to think we are, has changed, where people are not making you have to sign a card and get your blood drawn and like have a fingerprint. I am vegan. You know, but it's about like just, you know, kind of like showcasing this, and people are just, they're more inclined to respond. And I think people don't feel like they have to identify to take part.
Well, it's also about being accepted in the chef community. I mean, I've got, you know, most of the chef's numbers in the city of Philadelphia on my cell phone. You know, being invited to an event with Garces and Serpico and Sprague and all these guys, you know, I kind of go in there with my tail between my legs, you know, because I want it to be only about the food, and that's why I'm there. And next, you know, they're trying everything that I'm making, and I'm like, this is amazing. They're actually eating this, and they're not making fun of me. There are these kind of like, you know, inroads. They kind of get what we're doing, and they see all these products firsthand. They see the farms. We see vegetable farms. They see other farms. And I think they do relate to it on some level. And if that makes them put more vegetables on the menu, I'm fine with that. Secret identity. Yes.
Terrific. We want to open up the audience to questions. So I ask that if you do have a question, raise your hand. I will call on you. And someone will bring you a microphone. They are recording it, so they want you to wait until someone brings you a microphone.
I was just kind of curious how you got it started at Horizon. You know, what made you become a chef?
Well, I was a bartender for years before that, and I was really interested in the kitchen. I spent a lot of time in the kitchens I was working in, but I never wanted to be a part of it. I never wanted to break down chicken carcasses and boil lobsters, and I mean, Lord knows what else goes on back there. So, you know, when there's like vegetarian-friendly things in the kitchen, I would always dabble, and I was really, really interested in it. I was so fascinated by the process of how it came in boxes and cans or whatever, and then made it onto people's plates. I thought it was the most beautiful process. And so I started cooking like crazy, got my confidence together, and I was going to open up a lunch truck. And I was really, really close to doing it. And that's when I used to live in Roxborough. I walked down to this health food store one day, and they had all the space in there and a little cafe they weren't using. And I said, hey, why don't we go into business together? Why don't you rent me your cafe space? And you know, I felt like that was a very safe place to start. And she said, well, I'm actually closing, but it's really ironic that you came in, because my friend Bruce in Willow Grove is looking for someone to do exactly that. And that's how it all started. I just got this space. I think they sold me all their contents for like $3,000, and they just let me start cooking one day. You know, and I went to my dad about it, and he said, well, I don't see how you can really mess this up. You know, the rent was like $200, and I think you're pretty safe here. So, you know, once I had his blessing, I gave it a try, and that's how it all started. Yeah, and we just had to expand twice up there, because the demand for it, it just blew my mind that people actually wanted this food. I was confident in it, but you know, of course, you never know how the public's going to react to it. And so it was a very, very slow process. You know, the first expansion happened after, I think, 3.5 years. Then we expanded to that last unit, I think, in another, I mean, it was all of like, I mean, in Willow Grove was almost 11 years altogether. So it was a slow process, but it was a safe process. Not the one that I'd encourage anyone to do again, because you had to, you know, eventually break down and keep rebuilding again. So spend the money once or spend it 3 times. You know.
So I came to this country about 50 years ago, and you were too young to know what food was like, restaurant food was like then, but it was absolutely terrible. So it's still a miracle to me that how food has developed, and wine was discovered in the United States, and there's craft beer now and all of that. So there's been a tremendous change. And my question is this. Is what you are doing now influencing, let's say, Europe? I mean, do you see that what you are doing, or is something like this also happening in Europe and other places in the world?
That's such a fantastic question. Thanks, Tom. So we're very humble, and we don't want to think like, oh, you know, what we're doing is leading a charge. But we do try to take what we do so seriously, so that, you know, if people want to look to a model of a vegetable restaurant, we want to do the very best. And I think when we travel, because we try to do it as much as possible, we do as much research as we can. If we're going to a big city that has lots of fine restaurants and a range of restaurants, or if we're going to someplace that's much smaller, try to be very respectful of where we're going and figuring out what we're going to eat and what we'll experience. And I think, you know, having traveled a bit in Europe however many years ago, I feel like there were certain pockets that were very progressive with being a little bit more veg-friendly, and then other pockets that were much more traditional, where I never, ever thought you would ever see anyone pay any attention or credence to a vegetable, you know, diet, I guess. I feel like in Europe, though, that the quality was always there, the quality and the respect for food and taking the time to enjoy it and the idea of dining, they've always had that on us. But I think that in America, with a vegetarian sort of history, we've been able to maybe like showcase that you can take vegetables seriously. And one thing that we've done is sort of small plates have become a thing in restaurant culture, and certainly in Philadelphia and all the other like major dining spots. I think that helped us for people to take food seriously. They didn't really say you have to have, you know, protein and starch and veg and sauce to make a meal. Now you can make a meal out of lots of small plates. So I think that kind of changed people. And I guess, I mean, I don't know how you would take that one. I know in Paris, when I lived there for a brief time, there was nothing at all. And when we've been back more recently, I feel like you actually do find restaurants that will have a vegetarian, maybe even a vegan menu. I don't feel like I would have seen that, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Well, we also just came back from a short trip to Tennessee, and the only vegetable you can get in Tennessee is pork. We're really hungry. So I don't know. I mean, for as much as we think the world has changed, I think a lot of it really hasn't. But we see pockets of it. I mean, we're pretty lucky as Philadelphia. We're born and raised Philadelphians. We're really proud just to be representing our city and to hopefully have an influence on what people are serving and cooking down here. And we're really proud of that. So how that extends the reach, I don't know if we'll ever know. We do have a very interesting collection of area codes when we go through our reservation books, though. We've become touristy.
So you've become a destination.
Yeah, awesome. Unintentionally, but it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So we like it. Yeah, it's a great question, though. It's a very tough one to answer.
I'm wondering if you pack your son Rio's lunch when he goes to school.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'm wondering if all his classmates Google at what Rio is eating for lunch. And are you planning to have any influence on what children eat in the public schools?
Yeah, my favorite jobs of my day is packing lunch for our son, you know. It's awesome. I don't know. I ask him, you know, what are the other kids eating at the table? And, you know, I'll get to the point where I'm like, oh, okay, I don't want to hear it anymore. These poor kids don't know what they're eating.
What are the other kids eating at the table?
Oh, all sorts of processed foods and
everything
animals.
Everything is squeezable, and, you know, yeah. Like everything comes out of a tube.
Yeah, and I really don't want to make him the chef's son. You know, it's of course, it'd be easy to show off and, you know, put in some eggplant pate and a couple of crostinis and... You know, a little Belgian endive salad with some crisp pear. And you know. I don't. It's not like that. I make him food he wants to eat. You know, he's got a growing brain and got to feed him what he wants to eat. But we are really interested in what kids are eating these days. And it's really important, I think, that, you know, we just did this talk with Gene Bauer recently. And, you know, the theme of my speech was accountability with other chefs. I'm really, really tired of chefs getting up there and taking fresh seasonal asparagus and saying, well, let's put some butter and bacon on it and having the crowd applaud for that. The chefs have to be more accountable these days. Listen, I'm not here to tell them what to cook or what to eat. I want to lead by example, but don't glorify making something good like a vegetable bad for you by adding bacon and butter to it and thinking you're being cool and badass by doing it. It's completely wrong. They need to be more accountable. And so that's one message I'm hoping to get through to, you know, chefs and parents and kids all over, is that, you know, why in the world did anyone say, oh, you have to eat your vegetables? If you prepare vegetables right, they're great, you know? So
Don't mask the flavor, celebrate the flavor,
exactly,
is what you're trying to say.
Why
would you mask it with all bacon and butter? And
Well, don't think you're being cool by doing that. You know, don't call asparagus a sexy vegetarian dish because you have a fried egg and cheese on it. No, there's nothing sexy about heart disease. That's not funny. So accountability, I think, is really important.
I've been thinking that celebrity chefs are a really big part of food culture these days, and I actually embarrassingly have to admit that I first heard of you through watching Chopped. so I was wondering how that has impacted your career trajectory, and then I have a follow-up question for Kate. That kind of recognition, I feel like, has also been denied to a lot of women in the industry, and you've been a huge inspiration to me as this awesome pastry chef, and I, every time I go into View Street and I get the ice cream, it like lives on my dreams for the next few days. So I wanted to see how you see things changing and how your experience in the restaurant industry and being regarded by other chefs has been.
Well, I'll give you a quick answer so Kate can finish that one for you. You know, when I started in 1994, there was no such thing as a... Did I turn this off? Is it on? Ah, there we go. When I started in 94, there was no such thing as a celebrity chef. I think Emeril Lagasse was just starting out. It was really just unheard of. And then it's become part of our culture, and just by necessity, it's not why we do it. You know, like Kate mentioned, we're humble. Our motto is keep our heads down and just cook. It's all we want to do, impress people through the food, let the food talk. But I do recognize at the end of the day that there is a certain, you know, rock star thing going on with chefs, and if that helps bring attention to what we want to do, that's great. Again, it goes back to my earlier point, is my message to any young chef who starts out is do not get into this for any bit of celebrity at all. It's very, very, very hard work, and if you have your mind focused on being in front of a TV camera someday, you will fail. There is no way you can make it. It's about hard work. It's about being humble. It's about really, really putting your head down and making sure everything's right and never losing focus. You know, that being said, you know, if you can get out there with a message, if I'm up here with a microphone, make sure your message is good. Be accountable. Don't you know, think you're being cool by holding up a severed pig's head on your website, and don't think you're being cool by putting, you know, a fried egg on everything and covering vegetables with bacon. It's all about accountability. So listen, it's great. If chefs are going to be rock stars, it's great. It's wonderful. It is a beautiful, wonderful industry, you know, that we're really, really proud of. I do get a little upset at some of the mixed messages that some of these chefs can put out there, though, when they get the microphone.
Well, food is entertainment, right? People go out for their dinner and a show, and now it happens all in one place. So about, like, females in the industry, I guess. It's so interesting because I am very, I don't know, I'm very, post-feminist, I guess. I don't really like to think of, I like to think about individuals and what they're capable of. But I get this question often enough, and I understand that, like, where we're at in 2016, like, it's something that's noteworthy. So I'm happy to address it or talk about it. It's interesting, at V Street, like 9 out of 10 times, the entire cooking line is all female. And that's not intentional, it just happened that way. And it kind of has stayed that way. But people will notice it. And they'll often remark on like how cool they think that is. And we talked about it, and yeah, I think people were using a hashtag of like ladies night or something. And I don't know, I think that it's a fantastic industry, like Rich said. It's about hard work. It is about putting on a dinner party, entertaining people, and feeding people, and connecting. And it's artistic. You're expressing your food. Thank you for the nice words about the ice cream. I mean, it's like the best thing to know that your job ends up hopefully making people happy and like wanting to come back and like share it with friends. And I think as our culture changes, like, props to men and women, like, the hard work is shared by all of us, and I think just in general the culture in kitchens has changed, where people are, you know, they just take it more seriously, I think. It's not about being macho and about, like, tearing people down and yelling and trying to sabotage the new person by... But Rich had a funny joke once. He was going to tell them that the oven was, like, voice-activated so that their food would never turn out right. But, you know, like, there's still playfulness in kitchens, but I think they've become just more serious in general. So people are given opportunities, at least my experience, to just be an individual and come in and do your stuff. And, you know, for Rich and me, I'm proud to do every single job in the line. I want to do everything, and I don't want any special credit because of my gender. I just want to go in and be a really good chef. So hopefully that's the trend.
Thank you so very much. So I'm fascinated by your wonderful selection of vegan beer and wines. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So when we first got a liquor license, we had spent years as a BYO in Willow Grove, got a liquor license, thought, okay, like, we're going to figure this out. Rich had bartending experience. How hard could it be? We're going to do this. At the same time, like, cocktail culture and, you know, was becoming a bit more of a thing. And Rich shared with me everything he knew, but since I was more front of house, I was like, all right, I'm going to learn. So lo and behold, I start digging in. Someone's like, you know, not all wine is vegan. And I thought, well, what do you mean? It's made from grapes. What's going on? So I learned that many times wines or beers might be fined or filtered with animal products, therefore making them not vegan. I thought, oh my gosh, like, how am I going to figure out a decent wine list? I think the fear was that the only thing I could have would be Yellowtail, because that was the only one I was showing up on Barnivore as, like, certified vegan. But over time, as the craft beer movement has taken hold and the natural wine movement has taken hold, serious, delicious, small producers are making really great wines and beers. And if you ask the right questions, you don't say, is this wine vegan, but say, is this wine fined or filtered with any animal products? They'll know the answer to that, and they'll be able to tell you and sort of figure out vintage by vintage, you know, what the status is. So, yeah, it's about choosing really excellent wines that just so happen to meet that vegan parameter and then going from there. I'm happy to say in natural wines there's a huge, broad selection from all over the world, and the tendency for most natural winemakers is to do as little as possible. They don't want a finer filter. And same thing with beers. I think that beers are fascinating, especially what's going on in America, but you can find beautiful beers from all over that are very diverse and therefore make for a really great beverage menu throughout the year.
So I have sort of a triple question. Part one is, if you eat at home and you do have a young son, so I assume at times you eat at home that you're not just in the restaurants, who does the cooking there? What are your favorite things? How do you choose what to cook each night? And what are your favorite foods that you like to cook?
That's a great triple bar question. And I should thank our host. I thought this was water. This is gin, and I am very, very pleased. There should be an olive floating in this. Thank you. So when we cook at home, I usually do the cooking, and we go, honestly, I know it's like a cliche to say this, that when a chef is home, all they want is like spaghetti. It's really what we eat at home. We eat very simply at home. Nothing's too elaborate. We do that at the restaurant all day long. Really, when you get home, you just want a simple bowl of spaghetti. Sometimes we'll do that with vegan meatballs. Sometimes we do stir fry. We cook a lot of Asian food. Whether it be Chinese stir fry or Japanese noodles or you name it. I mean, you know, it's our favorite food in the world. It's the cleanest food in the world, and I think some of the most beautiful food in the world. But it's very, very simple. It's very humble. If you came over our house, you would not be impressed, you know. And so, and as far as our favorite foods, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, we've been to, let's see now, Singapore, Thailand, Japan, Hong Kong. Those foods just sing to us. Number one, they're naturally vegan. This is a culture that just doesn't eat dairy. At least, you know, as they're becoming more westernized, they are. So we've given them dairy and heart disease, and that's why they love us. So, but we find those foods so beautiful and so clean. Our first trip to Japan transformed us because we found that it wasn't a bunch of teriyaki sauces and goopy, sticky things like they do in this country. Very, very clean produce with, you know, for instance, one night we had a lotus root with hanchamiji mushrooms sauteed with a vegetable stock and finished with just a little dab of miso. So you ate it and you taste the vegetables first, and then it finished with this little bit of miso lingering on your palate. And every meal was like that, where it was all about the flavors and the ingredients first. Nothing was covered up or, you know, goopy. So that's what we eat at home a lot. What else do we do when we are there? It's not that often.
Almost every morning for breakfast, Rich will make some sort of noodle bowl. Like, I think yesterday he made a big pho, and then this morning it was like ramen noodles with like a red chili miso broth. So he's kind of, I don't know, he writes it off. See, he cooks so fast, he thinks there's nothing to it. But if I made the noodle bowls in the morning, first of all, I don't, because he just jumps into it. He's like, I'll take care of that. But it would take me a long time, and I'd make a mess, and I'd have a lot of work to do. But somehow he makes these delicious, like, hey, I'm using the broccoli stem and the onion peels and some garlic and some ginger, and he's made a vegetable broth. And we keep kombu sheets to season it, and there's dried mushrooms. So he actually does quite a lot in the morning with simple noodle bowls. I'm like a, I always like canned beans. I think that goes a long way in a salad, and like I love having avocados at home. I put citrus on everything when I cook, which is like once a month. If that. I love tempeh because I feel like it's really delicious and so easy to make quickly.
I was fascinated by your discussion of the preparation of the grilled carrots. And I realize that I do not have the world's most sophisticated palate by any means. How does one learn to appreciate the amount of work that goes into something like that, short of trying to make it on his or her own, and short of being a frequent flyer at your restaurant?
Wow. I mean, my first, before you said that last piece, my advice was come to the restaurant. Do not try this at home. I don't try it at home, so I don't think anyone else should either. You know, that's right. You know, I was warned about that. Don't cover up the bottom. So I finally got it after all this time. You know, there's a lot of shortcuts you can do. I think the happy medium is doing just a little bit more than you've always done, but you don't have to make it so elaborate. You know, you really, I can't cook that way at home. We don't have a commercial kitchen, kitchen like anybody else. So taking it a step further, I find, imagine your vegetables being in the center of the plate and without any animal protein there, and say to yourself, how am I gonna make these satisfying? How am I gonna make it so I'm just in love with these carrots? And I think you know, I mean, you're gonna know what you like. You're gonna know what's gonna satisfy you. You know, maybe you saute them and put a little sauce on them and finish them under the broiler so they can get a little crispy up top. Playing around just to do a little bit more than you've always done, I think goes a long way. Keeping your palate interested, trying something new that at the same time is kind of familiar to you and within your safety zone there. Oh no, just eat a veg. What am I saying, you know?
I think you missed your opportunity. You need to buy the cookbook.
Buy the cookbook. I'm not a salesperson either.
Thank you so much for coming out, and I want to thank Kate and Rich for coming and sharing, you know, their love of vegetable cooking. And, you know, you've really transformed the city. And I think what really demonstrates that is how much competition you now have. You are not the only vegan show in town. In fact, Philadelphia got a shout out from the New York Times. For, not to mention the Philadelphia Inquirer, we did a much better version of vegan Philadelphia.
You gotta read that.
But the New York Times really gave us a shout out saying that our vegan scene is very developed here.
The Post did too, Washington Post.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.